From The Nation magazine, this is Start Making Sense. I'm John Wiener. Today we're going to turn away from all the bad news and feature a couple of segments from our greatest hits collection. Later in the show, the synergy between politics and popular culture has never been clearer or stronger than in the age of Reagan. Jay Hoberman will explain. He's the author of a wonderful book called Make My Day, Film Culture in the Age of Reagan. Hoberman, of course, was a legendary film critic for The Village Voice for 30 years. But first, advice for men from a bestseller. Katha Pollitt will comment in a minute.
Now it's time to talk with Katha Pollitt about advice for men. Katha, of course, is an award-winning poet, essayist, and columnist for The Nation. We reached her today at home in New York. Hi, Katha.
Hi, John.
Well, when I saw that your new column is about Jordan Peterson, I immediately had a question. Who is he?
You're not alone. My friends are so out of it. They all have the same response. Who? What are you talking about? Jordan Peterson is immensely famous. His first book, 12 Rules for Life, An Antidote to Chaos, sold 5 million copies. I don't think you and I together sold even half of that. Okay. And it's slated for translation into 50 languages. But even more impressive than that, because a lot of people can buy a book and then, as you know, not read it, his YouTube channel has, get this, 3.68 million subscribers.
So you say these best-selling books are crammed with references to Nietzsche, Dostoevsky, the Bible, Jesus, and Jung. We're talking about big-time thinkers here. But what is the message that he finds in all these big-time thinkers? You say it's men should work hard, be responsible, and make your bed. Not sure that's really what Jesus said. Or Dostoevsky, but Katha, what's wrong with saying men should be responsible? Isn't that what you want too?
Well, don't forget the ancient Mesopotamian deities and Isis and Osiris, who also were probably not too big on making their beds, and figure significantly in this book. And we should mention he's the reason I wrote about him is there's a new volume.
Yes. More rules.
12 more rules for life. I think this book, the kind way of speaking about it, is that it does speak to a great confusion that many men feel. They want to get with the program, but they don't really know how to do it. And they want a purpose in life, and they don't have one. And of course, women want a purpose in life, too. But fewer of them are going to Jordan Peterson for that. He's also quite anti-feminist.
Let's start at the beginning here. What is Jordan Peterson's rule number one?
Stand up straight with your shoulders back.
So you're saying 5 million men paid $26 to be told stand up straight with your shoulders back? What is going on here?
That's not all. Rule 12 is pet a cat when you encounter one on the street.
I
see that reduced you to silence.
I'm stunned.
Well, I'm a big cat person, so I'm okay with that one.
I like cats too, but I don't pat them on the street because a lot of them don't want to be patted by strangers.
I know, but Jordan Peterson wouldn't care about that.
It's not about what the cat wants. I looked up the publicity for his new rules, his new book. And according to the publicity, the book has a thesis, which is too much security is dangerous. And that's because, quote, unchecked order can petrify us into submission. I think we have to agree that we do not want to be petrified into submission.
Yeah, he really has a way with words, doesn't he? But before I forget, I have to say that this book begins with a long, what he calls an overture in his pretentious way, in which he discusses all his physical problems, where he was on this all meat diet, which he was touting that this is just the best thing. Just eat nothing but meat, just meat, 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 meat. And then he became very sick and ended up in a coma in Russia. And he was in this coma, and he was also addicted to various prescription meds. And he talks about this on and on and on. See, people who write these books, How to Live, they very rarely have a lot of self-knowledge. That's probably why they think they can tell everybody else how to live. They're not really paying attention. So he had this whole thing with meat and prescription meds, but nonetheless, you should still do everything he says. I think his basic thing, and I was very soft on him, although it doesn't seem that way because I was having fun and being kind of snarky, but basically it appeals to the kind of rigid anti-woman feelings that some men have, where what they really want is a girlfriend, and yet, and they don't understand why they don't have a girlfriend. What's the matter with these horrible women? I hate them. They won't be my girlfriend. So his other rules have to do with things like, okay, work as hard as you possibly can on at least one thing and see what happens. So who could disagree with that?
Who could disagree?
And you could see how somebody's kind of adrift in life that, yeah, I should really find something I like doing, and I should try to do it really well. That's good. And then plan and work diligently to maintain the romance in your relationship. Well, this is straight out of a women's magazine, except I love plan and work diligently. That's a sort of militaristic approach to dating. Okay, so the last rule, be grateful in spite of your suffering. And what's interesting about that is that he acknowledges that people suffer. And yeah. I think in America, we're supposed to be happy all the time. And if you have real serious troubles, you keep them inside. And we don't get a lot of acknowledgement of loneliness, of feelings of failure, of all your personal relationships being very difficult, all that. And he says, yeah, of course you're miserable and I'm going to fix you.
Yeah. Well, you know, he does say there's one other revealing thing related to that. The Amazon page for his new book has an excerpt that begins, "Don't do work that makes you contemptuous of yourself, feeling weak and ashamed," close quote. Now, of course, that's great advice, but it's interesting that he is acknowledging what many of his readers feel, that they feel weak and ashamed and contemptuous of themselves. That's pretty radical, as you say, for an American.
It is not very American. It's not very manly. Manly is kind of the opposite of those things, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so I think you have a lot of people who feel their life isn't working out and they have to work at a job they hate, and maybe they don't feel they're very good at it, but maybe those two things are related. And because people tend not to be really good at things that they don't enjoy or approve of. Feminists hate Jordan Peterson. Let's just get that on the table. They hate him. And in fact, the publishing company of this book, the hundreds of the young staffers signed a petition, don't publish this.
Oh, man.
That wasn't going to happen, given what his sales figures are. But so he's widely hated on the left and especially by feminists. And I think that's fair. I'm just amazed anybody can get through this book because it's so disastrously badly written. It's so tedious. It reminds me of, like, you probably have had students that postpone their paper until the night before, but the paper is long. It's like you have to write 40 pages. And so they just put in everything they have ever known or thought, everything they have read. And that's where you get all this crazy, you know, Isis and Osiris. I'm sure they can come in here somewhere.
Well, another one that he brings in that I was sort of surprised to see is he has a thing about humans are a lot like lobsters.
Oh, lobsters. Yeah.
What does he mean by that?
You can go to his website and there's all these lobster themed things you can buy, like a necktie, a t-shirt, a cover for your cell phone with these little lobsters. And the t-shirt, I think, says Hail Lobster, maybe that's the hat, Hail Lobster. So the lobster, according to him, is very much like people. in the following way. Because of some neurological similarity, the fact that lobsters are basically hostile and competitive and territorial means that that's the way people are.
I saw that you mentioned this, and then I Googled, what is the lobster personality? And the first thing that came up was, despite their warlike appearance, lobsters are actually sensitive and delicate animals. That's from the website animalsofaustralia.com.
Well, so now I have to feel guilty again for eating lobster rolls. I thought Jordan Peterson was giving me permission to have as many as I wanted.
Then I also found on Google that the Swiss government just passed a law stating people can no longer boil a lobster alive.
I'm gobsmacked. What they'll have to take that famous scene out of Annie Hall, remember?
My point is, he seems to be wrong about lobsters.
And many other things as
and
well.
And many other things.
For example, women, he said.
Yes.
In volume two, in the volume I'm discussing, he talks very little about feminism. There's only a couple of mentions because he got into so much trouble in book one talking about them and feminists. And so, but he says, you know, no matter what feminists say, I've seen it time and time again, what women, all women basically want to have children. And I'm thinking, I don't think so. I think a lot of women wanted to have children, but, you know, maybe 80%, but it's not something all women want. But his thing is, okay, all women want to have children. They are being led up the garden path by feminism to focus on their careers. And then wham, bam, it's too late. You know, they've got fertility problems. But another problem they have is men.
This is your view. This is your view.
This is my view, that the men that this book is written for are not really boyfriend material.
Yeah, you say the basic problem Jordan Peterson is addressing is that men are having a hard time getting quality girlfriends and now have to make more of an effort to be what you call boyfriend material. What is the cause of this problem, in your view?
In my view, I think that they haven't really reckoned with, a lot of men haven't really reckoned with feminism and what it requires of them. They still are with the old mindset. And then they're constantly surprised when women put them in the friend zone, for example.
At this point, I think we have to talk about incels, involuntary celibates, one of the most searched terms on Google last year, it turns out. What advice does Jordan Peterson have for incels?
Do not allow yourself to become resentful, deceitful, or arrogant. That's rule 11. It's good advice if you can follow it. But incels love Jordan Peterson. I think there's people like his militarism, his rigidity, his kind of straighten up and fly right, like my father used to say. They want that old, that patriarchal thing. And it's not so easy to find that patriarchal thing in a psychologist, which is what he is. You have to go to, you know, a superhero movie to get that. But now you can have Jordan Peterson.
Okay, you don't think Jordan Peterson is a good source of advice, despite the fact that he sold millions of books and dozens of languages. Have you got anything better to offer as wisdom for how to live these days?
Well, my husband and I have been reading out loud for a very long time Marcus Aurelius's Meditations. Now, I have to say that the classicist I revere, Mary Beard, thinks the Stoics are terrible people. They're fascists. Marcus Aurelius was just a major war maker, which he mentions occasionally in the book. But I feel this book has been guiding people through the struggles of life for over 1,000 years. And unlike Jordan Peterson, it's well-written and it's short. And at the end of my column, I summarize his advice. Okay, rule one. These are better rules than Jordan Peterson's. Rule one, try as hard as you can to be a good, responsible, serious person. Rule two, be aware that much of life is out of your control. You just have to accept that. And rule three, in any case, soon you will be dead.
Soon you will be dead. Katha Pollitt wrote about Jordan Peterson's advice for men in her latest column. You can read it at thenation.com. Katha, I don't care what you say. I'm going to stand up straight from now on.
Me too. And shoulders back. Shoulders back.
We spoke with Katha in June 2021.
The synergy between politics and popular culture has never been clearer or stronger than in the age of Reagan. And now there's a wonderful new book on movie culture in the age of Reagan. It's called Make My Day, and the author is Jay Hoberman. For 30 years, he was a film critic for The Village Voice. He's also written for Art Forum, The New York Review, The New York Times, and The Nation. He's written a dozen books, including the brilliant Army of Phantoms, American Movies in the Making of the Cold War. Jay Hoberman, welcome back.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
When you write about movie culture in the age of Reagan, you focus not on what you think are the best movies of the 80s or the movies you most admire. In fact, you pay a lot of attention to the movies you dislike. Why is that?
Well, the fact that I dislike these movies doesn't mean that they're not interesting for me to write about. And I chose movies that I felt were symptomatic of what was going on both in politics and the culture at large.
And Reagan, of course, was often dismissed by liberals as just an actor from old Hollywood. But you think the fact that he was part of old Hollywood gave him a special power and success as president?
Definitely. There are two things here. I mean, first of all, when he ran for governor of California, the liberals and the Democrats just did not take him seriously. He seemed like a lightweight. And how is he going to beat Pat Brown, a two-term governor of California and a real political powerhouse? What they didn't realize was that an actor knows how to present. An actor knows how to deliver a line. An actor can hit their marks. It's very difficult for a politician to compete with somebody who's that polished and professional at projecting an image. The other thing, and maybe the more significant one, is that Reagan bought into the whole Hollywood package, particularly in the 1940s. And what I mean by that is that, taken as a whole, American movies had a particular kind of ideology. They were very optimistic, forward-thinking, imagined that they were inclusive. I mean, in fact, they were not, but they had that self-appointed sense of universal appeal. Certainly, they wanted to appeal universally. And mandated happy endings. I mean, there was a production code into the 1960s that kept things from getting too real. I think that Reagan internalized all of this, and this is why I consider him Hollywood's greatest creation. I mean, he sincerely believed this stuff. And the one real takeaway I had from doing research at the Reagan Library, if I'm not mistaken, you've done work there too, have
yes.
you not? But what I did take away from this was the degree to which Hollywood was still so central in his thinking. I mean, you know, his wife had been in the movies also. Nancy was a minor star. And I really think that this was the high point of their lives. I mean, being president was very nice, and he certainly enjoyed it. But I think that it's really not as great as being a movie star, even when he wasn't, you know, in the first rung. I mean, just to be part of that. And I say this because they stayed in touch with people. They spent a lot of time reaching out, you know, making videos. I mean, they spent a month making a birthday video for Lou Wasserman, who had been their agent and who was at that time the leading Democratic fundraiser in California. Did not make any difference to them. He was, you know, they were together in showbiz. He was their guru, you know, he was their rabbi. And so he was not a great movie star, but I think he embodied Hollywood more completely than any other star.
Well, let's talk about some of the movies. After Reagan was reelected in 1984 in a landslide, you wrote a big piece for the Village Voice where you said that during that campaign year, only one film, quote, mirrored Reaganism in full flower. And that film was Ghostbusters. You called it aesthetically weak, but ideologically potent. Tell us about Ghostbusters.
Okay. Now, the reason I said that was that Ghostbusters, I think objectively, and, you know, I was a working movie critic in 1984, so I saw a lot of movies. I didn't find Ghostbusters really that funny. I mean, I saw certain things in it that were appealing, but, you know, the setup was kind of fun, but the movie was not that funny. But it inspired, like, almost, you know, like a fanatical devotion. It overperformed. People saw something in there that they really wanted. And I think that the same thing was true with Reagan. And it's not like Ghostbusters is an allegory of Reaganism or that Reagan was taking cues from Ghostbusters. It's that they're both symptomatic of the same thing, this longing for the world to be in a certain way. And, you know, you and I remember this, but lots of people don't. 1984 was a year that had, like, a really uncanny significance for Americans and for people in the West in general, being the year of George Orwell's dystopian novel.
Yeah.
And I feel that, in a funny sort of way, both Reagan and the movie liquidated that anxiety. And this is despite the fact that Reagan was a terrible saber rattler, if not warmonger, you know, throughout 1983. I mean, he conjured up a crisis, which he then dissipated, which is exactly what the Ghostbusters are accused of doing in the movie, you know, like inventing ghosts so that they can exorcise them. But I think, you know, there are two key aspects where the movie and the campaign coincide. Well, three, actually, because Ghostbusters makes such a big deal about making the guy from the Environmental Protection Agency like this really humorless, uptight, annoying kind of hippie type. You know, I mean, so they're against regulation. Reagan, you know, hated regulation. You know, they consider that they've come up with this fantastic entrepreneurial plan. At one point, Bill Murray says, "I've worked in the private sector. They demand results." So the Wall Street Journal picked up on this, incidentally, when they saw the movie as being, like, right there, you know, like a business school. Perfect. And the other thing is that they've invented what they call the indispensable defense science for the, I don't know, for the 20th century or something like that.
In 1983, Reagan announced his anti-missile defense system. He called it Star Wars. Wasn't that also a movie?
That was a movie. And, of course, you know, I think it was at that time still the top-grossing movie ever. And he didn't call it Star Wars. That was the press, and the Democrats called it Star Wars. And they thought that that was, you know, a sign that they were dissing it. It was a kind of derisive term. But Reagan understood that that was like a great term, that they handed him, you know, a wonderful trademark. I mean, George Lucas wasn't happy about it, and Reagan had this riff on. They said, "Well, you know, they call it Star Wars, but, you know, we'll do it, and, you know, the Force will be with us," or something like that. So he pretended to object to the title, but then he, you know, like, used another phrase from the movie.
You call Star Wars, quote, a seamless blend of Walt Disney and Leni Riefenstahl. Wow. Yeah.
Well, Star Wars is an amazing entertainment package. It has this, you know, grade school narrative, and I mean that literally. I mean, it is a kid's movie. The fact that it appealed, you know, universally can tell us something about what the audience wanted in those days. So it has this kind of grade school account of a rebellion against a tyranny, and it's, how can you can't quite figure it out, you know, like the princess is also part of the Republic. And, you know, I mean, it's basically like young people against old, young people and robots against old mean people. But the slickness of it, the way that Lucas fetishizes hardware and, you know, these spectacular scenes. There are scenes that quote directly from Leni Riefenstahl's Triumph of the Will. And it's not innocent. I mean, he went to film school. So he certainly was familiar with these movies. And it's not that I'm saying that Star Wars is a fascist movie, although it has been said it's a movie that a fascist audience might enjoy. But that he didn't care. It was something that worked.
In a third film we need to talk about, one of Reagan's most famous lines was, "Go ahead, make my day." This was in 1985 when he was telling Congress that he would veto any tax increase. It's Make My Day is the title of your book. And of course, it comes from a Clint Eastwood Dirty Harry movie, the 1983 film Sudden Impact. Let's talk about Clint Eastwood's persona on screen.
Okay. I mean, Eastwood was, during much of the 70s and into the 80s, the number one male star, which is to say the number one star. To me, that's very interesting because whoever's the number one star with John Wayne for a long time is kind of American male ego ideal. And Eastwood was that, although the thing with Eastwood was that he was a more ambiguous character than John Wayne. He was hipper in a way. I mean, I remember when he first started making movies, people thought that, oh, maybe he's like, you know, closer to James Dean than to John Wayne. There's a certain moral ambiguity. And when he played Dirty Harry, he was a figure that I call like the legal vigilante. I mean, he could break the law because he was right. Some people saw that as a sort of fascist figure. In any case, he had some very good lines, which he could deliver, and Make My Day was one of them. I forget who did the screenplay for Sudden Impact. But it was a terrific line, and I think he delivered it to somebody. It was one of these things, are they going to draw their gun? You know, yeah, go ahead and draw, and I'll shoot you, and it'll make my day, that kind of thing. But Reagan just understood it. It stayed with him. I don't think anybody wrote that for him. I think that it just popped out the way a lot of movie lines would pop out of his mouth in certain situations. And the fact that he's casting himself as Dirty Harry is very powerful. I mean, Dirty Harry was like the toughest cop in America, you know, which means the toughest cop in the world.
You end your book, Make My Day, with a terrific epilogue comparing and contrasting Reagan and Trump. Both came out of an entertainment background. Both were polished salesmen who became president, but the differences are pretty interesting. Reagan, you have said, was old Hollywood incarnate, you know, the happy ending. Trump clearly is not about happy endings, and his background in entertainment is very different.
Yes. Obviously, he's a creature of television, of reality TV, but also of Fox. I mean, he was a political pundit on Fox for a few years, and also was involved in wrestling too, and has been involved in a lot of these tawdry showbiz things. So Trump understands that the kind of entertainment that he's good at and is by nature divisive. You know, you want to create villains and polarize the audience, you know, to rev them up. You know, Reagan had his demagogic instincts, certainly, particularly when he ran for governor of California, but he was more inclined to bring people together, as was said, the way that movies do, you know, make a scenario that appeals to the greatest number of people. Trump has no interest in that. I mean, he's got his audience.
Well, in your book, you say Trump is a synthesis of two great movie demagogues of 1976, Howard Beale of Network, and especially Sylvester Stallone's Rocky. Let's focus on Rocky here for a minute, because it seems to me there's a lot of Rocky in the Trump persona.
Yes. Well, first of all politicians love Rocky. I mean, the Rocky theme is a sort of the unofficial anthem of anybody running for president, any man. You know, women don't tend to use it in the same way. The thing with Rocky is that Rocky put a kind of smile face on a form of nativism, and specifically on racism. I mean, this was really the motor of that movie. The movie was all about the original Rocky, although, you know, it comes up again in the other ones, about putting Muhammad Ali, probably perceived as like the biggest threat in American popular culture since Elvis, and maybe a bigger threat, putting him in his place. And that's what that movie's about. You know, some lovable, you know, a white palooka, you know, a club fighter comes out of the past and fights this horrendous, powerful black man to a standstill. And it's that, and that's the happy ending. So, sure, I mean, that's the kind of thing that would appeal to Trump in his sunnier moves. But I think that Howard Beale, who could just get on television and rant and rave, get people to like go to their windows and respond to him, is a model for him too.
So in conclusion, you say Reagan's movie was America, the idealized happy America of his imagination. What is Trump's movie about?
I think Trump's movie is about Trump, and I think that he has succeeded in making himself such a compelling figure that he dominates this landscape. I don't know that people felt that way about Reagan. I think that Reagan was, he could be like an everyman writ large in a way, if that's what he wanted to play. You know, Trump, you know, is like the villain from a superhero movie. He's a menace. And I think people are transfixed by that. I mean, some people, I mean, it would be, you know, he certainly does not appeal to everybody. In fact, arguably, he's the least appealing president ever. But the people who like him really do like him. And it's him that they like.
Jay Hoberman, his new book is Make My Day, Movie Culture in the Age of Reagan. It's totally great. Jim, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
We spoke with Jay Hoberman in August 2019.
Start Making Sense, a podcast from The Nation magazine, is co-produced by the LA Review of Books and recorded in Los Angeles at our Blythe Avenue studios. Renee Reynolds is our associate producer. Alan Minsky is our producer. Ludwig Hurtado is our executive producer. D.D. Guttenplan is editor of The Nation. Bhaskar Sunkara is president of The Nation. And Katrina Vandenhoevel is publisher and editorial director of The Nation. Our theme music is from Barcelona Afrobeat, licensed by Creative Commons. You can find out more about Start Making Sense at thenation.com. And subscribe to Start Making Sense on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm John Wiener. Thanks for listening.
Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? I'm Kat, founder of Ritual. We're making traceability the new standard for the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I couldn't find a multivitamin I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested, and clean label project certified. Oh, and our vitamin D3? It comes from sustainably harvested lichen from England, not sheep. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.